Welcome to Research Bites, the podcast about research students and their journey in academia. My name is Lachlan Gray. I'm joined by my co-hosts Imtiaz Desai and Felix Cohane. Congratulations, Imtiaz, for submitting your thesis.
Thank you.
Let's go.
Yeah, fucking huge congratulations. Okay, today I'm joined by my very special guest, Trevor Atkinson, and he is a PhD student at the Garvan Institute of Medical Research, doing some work on stem cell villages. So, Trevor, how's it going?
Great. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So we'd like to start off the podcast with just a brief background of how you got into your PhD. So where did you study at university and how did you get here?
Sure. I studied biology at the University of Virginia. While I was there, I worked in Jen Sokolowski's lab doing immune research in the brain. We were looking at the presence of immune cells in samples from stroke patients from the University of Virginia Hospital. From there, I went on to work in Beth Stevens' lab at the Broad Institute. Beth's lab is focused on looking at different microglia states and how microglia may play a role in various neurodegenerative diseases. So in my time in Beth's lab, we were taking stem cells and differentiating them down to microglia, which are the immune cells of the brain, using various combinations of chemicals. Then when we would take these cultured microglia, we would expose them to various substrates found in the brain and try to understand whether microglia are playing a beneficial or a potential detrimental role in various neurodegenerative diseases. So in particular, we were interested in this state called DAM, or disease-associated microglia, and what you can do is take microglia derived from stem cells and expose them to amyloid plaques or neurofibrillary tangles, which are found in Alzheimer's, and sort of see what are the transcriptomic changes that microglia may be experiencing, and are these various transcriptomic states that microglia are entering beneficial, detrimental, or playing some other role that we are not really sure about.
Kind of sounds like that's quite like an interesting project, because you've got quite a complex like biology model development, or I don't know if it's development, but a complex model that you're then applying bioinformatics to. Is that right? Were you involved in sequencing these cells?
During my time there, I was working as an RA, so I was mostly doing the sample prep and the differentiating and running the experiments, and then some other people were helping with the data analysis of the single cell sequencing. We were constantly trying to get the model more and more accurate and replicating in vivo states. So right before I left, we were actually trying some transgenic animals and working with some chimeric models. So what that involved was taking the stem cells, differentiating them to an intermediate microglia state. So instead of doing the full 40 days, we just do the first 10 days. And then what we could do is inject those intermediate cells, which we called HPCs, or hematopoietic progenitor cells, into the brains of early stage mice. So P0, so just mice that have just been born. And then what you can do is let the mouse age for 6 months or 9 months. And what that allows us to do is, instead of growing cells in a dish, which is not a very accurate model of what the brain actually looks like, you're growing them in a 3D system where they're interacting with other cell types. They're actually able to tile the brain in the way that your brain may tile itself, and how microglia may function actually in a more in vivo model. And what we could then do is let those cells grow for 6 to 9 months in these transgenic mice, and then sac the mouse and extract the human microglia. And through a process called flow cytometry, where you stain the cells for specific antibodies, you can actually pull out just the human cells and leave everything else. And we can look at, okay, what are the various cell types that are forming, and how are the cells behaving in that brain environment?
It's super interesting. I think you kind of mentioned it, like that you're trying to add complexity to the model. But can you kind of speak to, you know, why that's important? Also, maybe like I feel like, as someone who also works in cell culture, just for people who don't really who are exposed to this kind of work, what does that even mean? I'm sure this is happened to you at a party where you're saying, oh, you know, I have to run off, I've got to go passage my cells. Everyone kind of looks at you like, what the hell does that mean?
Sure.
So how do people in research use cell culture? And then also, can you maybe speak to what a stem cell is used for in that kind of context, and how that might differ from, say, like an immortalized cell line that a lot of people might be familiar with?
Sure. I tend to equate working with stem cells with maybe running a preschool with very sensitive and needy children. Just because they constantly need to be fed, and there are many ways where you can screw them up. But
just like children.
Exactly. I would say, so in the past 10 or 15 years, there's been the development of induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPSCs. And what they allow us to do is basically model various states or cells in the body outside the body. And so what we can do is take stem cells from whoever we want. You know, you can take some skin cells from, let's say, me, and turn them into induced pluripotent stem cells. And then by exposing them to various chemicals, we can turn those stem cells into any cell type in the body. We can turn them into heart cells, brain cells, liver cells, whatever we really want. The big problem with these induced pluripotent stem cells and the models that they're used for is maturity and actually being able to replicate what's found in the body, outside the body. We've got somewhat of an understanding of how differentiation works. So the various factors and patterns that your body basically replicates to create a complex body that you're in now. But I would say our understanding is very incomplete, and our ability to replicate the conditions that allow for accurate differentiation is also incomplete as well. To answer your second question about stem cells versus immortalized cell lines. So with stem cells, we can grow these various models of the body. And I would say that they're actually much more accurate in terms of replicating how the body operates and how development actually looks. Immortalized cell lines are, I mean, you'd probably know better than I do, but immortalized cell lines have the ability to live indefinitely outside the body, and you can use them for various experiments in terms of understanding how cancer develops and how genetic changes may impact how cells behave, which you can also do with stem cells as well.
Mm. Yeah, and this is like you know, such a big part, I feel like, of a lot of cell biologists' work is culturing and keeping alive cells. Do you like doing that?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Do you guys want me to get into some of my work I'm doing in Joseph's group now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just had like a question more maybe like conceptually, but so just so I understand, you're taking cells, so maybe like skin cells, or what are the other cells you can turn back into stem cells?
I mean, hypothetically, you could do it with anything, but people tend to do fibroblasts or skin cells.
And so as a person that works behind the computer, I just think that you're like, there's like some big purple potion you put the cells through, and it's like magic. I don't know how you get the cells from that to that.
Yeah.
But if you were to take are those stem cells the same as the stem cells that you would find in that person's body, or are they kind of different? Are they like behaving differently than what the actual stem cells would be behaving as?
Yeah, good question. In, I think, 2009, this Japanese researcher, his last name is Yamamoto, discovered four transcription factors, which are basically regulators of gene expression that regulate pluripotency. Pluripotency is the ability of a cell to turn into any other cell type. And so he found that by turning on these four transcription factors, we could take any cell we wanted and turn it into a stem cell. And then those cells would then develop the ability to be pluripotent, and they could be differentiated into heart cells, liver cells, brain cells, like we said before. What was your second question? Sorry.
Well, just are they as functional as a stem cell in the human body?
Yeah, good question. So if you think about development from fertilization, so when a sperm meets an egg all the way through to a full adult human body, the cells at the beginning in what's called a blastocyst or an embryo, those are fully pluripotent. So they could turn into any cell type in the body. They can turn into brain, liver, or, you know, whatever you want. But adults also have stem cells in their organs. So in your liver, you have some adult stem cells in there. And let's say, you know, somebody's a really bad drinker and they cause damage to their liver. The stem cells in the liver are actually able to regrow and sort of protect the adult organs. But the thing is, you know, if you have cells in your stem cells in your liver, they're not going to be able to turn into brain cells or, you know, retinal cells. Those cells are limited in their pluripotency, and so they can only really turn into the tissue type that they're found in.
Okay, I've got different names. I forget what they're called. Is that pluripotency?
Totipotency. Can't remember the
name. Year 11 biology. It's too long, yeah.
So this was your RA work.
That's right.
In the States. And when did you leave that to get here in Australia to do a PhD, and why?
That's a good question. So about 2 years into my RA work, I was thinking about my next steps, and I was considering doing a PhD, but the PhD process in the US can be quite involved. It's a really big time investment. And I think for my personal career, I want to work in biotech long term. So I'm curious about, you know, the intersection of biology and business. And I thought maybe it's good to go and get a PhD to credential myself and sort of learn a little bit about how science is applied more in depth, but also position myself for working in industry long term. Honestly, I got a call from a friend, and his name is Henry Clabby. I live with him now in Australia. And he called me and he said, let's move to Australia. And I was like, fuck yeah, let's do it. And so I started looking around. I was like, I looked for industry jobs in Australia, and that's not a very developed field right now, unfortunately. I think it's definitely growing. There's some really good startups that are coming through. But then I sort of pivoted and I was looking at different PhD opportunities. And initially I was very interested in a lab in Melbourne. But through the networking process and just sort of getting a lay of the land, you know, the research field in Australia is quite small. People all know each other. I got put in contact with my researcher that I'm now working with. His name's Joseph Powell. He works at the Garvan Institute. And his lab is focused on population genomics. So how do different genes across a population, so differences between maybe the four of us, impact how our bodies develop, how our bodies respond to disease treatment. You know, it's really trying to understand how someone's genetics impact how their bodies operate.
Such a big, question. There are so many different questions that could be answered there. What's the kind of question that you're most interested in around that space?
Yeah, it's a huge opportunity. I think it's also potentially difficult sometimes for people to carve out maybe a specific niche for themselves. One thing I really like about Joseph's group is he's got so many different researchers addressing this problem from all these different directions. There's some people who are working with these massive data sets, trying to understand, you know, how various cell types are present across different people and, you know, how their genetics impact how they develop disease. I would say I'm more interested in practical applications in trying to actually, you know, grow these models ourselves and see how we can play around with the model and see how it leads to differences in disease treatment or development or some of these other questions we have.
Yeah, well, that leads into your PhD project. So what is a cell village? Like, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, definitely. So people would tend to run experiments on, let's say I'm trying to understand how a specific gene impacts how my body develops. So what we can do is take three people or two people, one who has the gene and one person who does not have the gene, and try and make inferences about how that specific gene impacts development. The thing is, there's so many different confounding factors and there's so many different genes between people that it makes these kind of studies really difficult to run. Additionally, like running these stem cell experiments that I just described are quite expensive and a very time intensive process. And so trying to run, you know, 200 of these experiments in parallel is really time and money intensive. A new idea in the field is this concept of stem cell villages. And so the idea is instead of running 200 experiments in parallel where you've got 200 different people's cells, you can take those cells from 200 different people and actually pool them together into one experiment. And so what this allows you to do is look at population differences across the population. So, you know, how the various genetics of these 200 people differ, and then take those stem cells, the stem cell village, and differentiate them to cardiomyocytes or whatever cell type you're interested in, and look at how those different genetics may impact the processes of development or disease progression.
Yeah, I think it's a really cool, it's such an interesting and cool idea. It also still blows my mind. I think one thing to make clear to people who don't culture cells is that a lot of these cells have very different growth requirements. And like thinking that the idea that I could just take one cell line from one patient and move it into the same dish, like when you say, can we do it in the same experiment? You'd literally mean in the same dish, right?
That's right.
You're culturing four or five different cell lines within a single dish. That's insane to me. I've read
it just sounds like contamination.
Yeah. I would say like
so you just like sneeze into the thing and just hope for the best? Or?
Yeah. Exactly. We line up 200 people. We asked them all to see us.
This idea is, I would say, goes against a lot of the like initial principles of stem cell research. So the idea is previously you'd have to grow each stem cell line individually to really understand what is the relationship between the genetics of this stem cell line and how it's behaving. With the stem cell villages idea, like you said, Felix, you're actually just taking those stem cells and you're putting them all together from different people. This has only really been, possible due to some recent advances in bioinformatics. So there's a process called demultiplexing, and demultiplexing basically allows you to understand which cell is from which person. Because previously, if you took cells from 200 different people and you mix them all together, and then you tried to understand how someone's individual genetics were impacting how their cell was behaving, you would have no idea whose cell was from which person. But with demultiplexing, what you can do is look at specific variants. So little differences in all of our genomes and be able to understand, okay, cell A is from Trevor and cell B is from Felix and cell C is from Lachlan.
So you can analyze them individually, but then you can also obviously analyze them together and look at the shared relationships between certain genes and things like this. And
that's right. So the methodology is basically, let's say we've got our 200 person village and we see that person A's cells respond well to drug treatment. And person B's cells respond poorly. Because oftentimes, like if you look across a population, some people respond really well to a medicine and some people respond really poorly. So person A cells respond well and person B cells respond poorly. What we can then do is look at, okay, what are the genes that are different between these two people? And what are the shared genes between the good responders? And what are the shared genes between the bad responders? And then we can make inferences. Okay, so it looks like with this drug, if you have this specific genetic combination, you're not going to respond well. If you have a different genetic combination, maybe you respond really poorly or really, yeah. And so the ultimate goal long-term is basically, once we have a deep understanding of how specific genotypes are connected to drugs, somebody could come in for an early stage drug treatment. Let's say I've got some sort of early cardiac issue. And they could do a genetic test and they say, because of your specific genetic combination, we know that you'll respond well to this drug treatment paradigm. So we're going to prescribe these drugs that have been shown to work specifically for people just like you.
So a much more precision approach to medicine, yeah?
That's right.
And how long has demultiplexing been around now for? It's a new concept to me.
Yeah. Not too long. I would say, I think the first village paper was maybe 2012 or 15.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe around 10 years.
Can you speak to I think the other thing that I really like about this idea is, so one, you're increasing the heterogeneity of the model by increasing the underlying genetic variation by including more patients within your experiments. But you also mentioned that you are enhancing the scalability of the experiments. So maybe you can analyze now 10x more cells or 10x more patients. Why is that important for population genetics? Are these things, I'm kind of answering my own question, but how these things are quite rare diseases or rare genetic manipulation, mutation.
Variants,
that's the word. SNPs. So these are quite rare and you're interested in how they affect is it, you know, phenotype, human phenotype?
Were you, that Felix, that's a fantastic question. And that really gets to the root of why we're doing this research. Previously, when people would do research, maybe they would take 3 stem cell lines and they would test some drugs, and then they would make broad conclusions, broad sweeping conclusions about how humans responded to disease, a disease treatment. The thing is, we all have different genetics. And I think more and more people are understanding that differences in our genetics have so many impacts on, you know, our likelihood of developing depression, you know, our how long we live, and then even, you know, if we like the taste of cilantro or not, or coriander, sorry. And so with these stem cell villages and with population genomic studies in general, we are able to try and really delve into how somebody's genetics operate in the real world, and, you know, how people's genes impact medicine, and sort of trying to create precision medicine opportunities for everybody. Because previously, when they did drug treatment testing, they would just choose, you know, a population of, I think, in general, white men, and test the drug on them, and then develop, you know, drug dosing and drug toxicity guidelines based on those tests. But it's been shown more and more that you know, if you're an Asian woman or if you're an indigenous man, like how your body responds to these different drugs is very different. And we need to make that, you know, set those specific drug dosages for everybody's specific genotype.
But just like a thought on that, I mean, obviously this is the reason why you're doing this research, but my understanding is that a complex trait, which I suspect response to a drug would be described as a complex trait, would be the combination of many different genetic variants, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just like one gene, oh, you're going to respond this way to this sort of drug. It'd be many different variants, right? And so you're saying that within your village, you can look to see about the genes or the variants that are similar between like the high responders or the low responders. But then how common will those be within like a general population? Because how many, what's the maximum of individuals per dish that you're looking at? Or how many people do you have, like, I guess in general, across the whole study?
I think the more we scale these kind of experiments, the more power we have. Right now, we've got about 200 individuals. And they're really, they're sampled from...
In one dish, 200?
In one experiment.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's taken a lot of legwork to sort of analyze the growth rates of these different individuals and then pool based on growth rates. And yeah, there's a lot of very nitty gritty stem cell culture.
What's like the upper limit? Like what's like, how many people can you fit into it? It's like a phone box. Like how many people can you fit into a village, into a dish? Yeah.
Well,
maybe not a New York City, maybe like a Sydney.
I mean, really, it's like if you scale the experiment more and more, I think the more people you can fit in. I will say that
like, is it the bigger the dish? Do you need like a bigger one? Like, or is that?
Yeah, no, actually, you do. I mean, if you created a village of, you know, 3 individuals, then if there's a total of 1,000 cells, then you'd have 333 cells per person. If you have a, you know, a village of 1,000 people and there's only 1,000 cells total, then you only have 1 cell per person. And you need enough cells per person to really be able to make, you know, strong conclusions about how their cells are behaving. So that is definitely one of the caveats. So recently we've been trying to optimize our model. We take stem cells and we've been differentiating them to cardiomyocytes. And it's been shown that in general, when people have cancer and they take chemotherapy medicines, chemotherapy drugs are oftentimes very toxic for your heart, just because your heart is very energy intensive. And then also... It may also have a lot of cell replication, and chemotherapy drugs often target cell replication. And so if we can find a way to pair people who have cancer with the right chemotherapy drugs, then we can probably prevent a lot of cardiotoxicity. But one of the issues with our model is trying to actually grow hearts in a dish is not an easy process. Mm. And oftentimes the yield of heart cells, let's say you start with 1,000 stem cells and your efficiency is 70%, you're only getting 700 heart cells, and the rest are all, you know, other cells that we're not as interested in. And so we've been trying to increase the efficiency of our model to try and make sure that at the end of the differentiation, when we are really curious about these later stages of the village, we have enough cells of a good cell type, and then across the different individuals in the village as well.
So you mentioned earlier the PhD process in the States, quite different, much longer, yeah? You're about 1.5 years in now to what is typically a 3.5 or 4 year project here in Australia. Where are you at now and what are your immediate next steps?
Yeah, that's a good question. We are at the stage where we are running large-scale longitudinal assays. So what that means is we're trying to understand how people's genetics impact how cells develop. And so what that looks like is basically taking a differentiation, so stem cells, and turning them into cardiomyocytes and sampling cells along the way. So we can collect cells at day 4, collect cells at day 8, collect cells at day 20 and say, what are the differences between these cells? How are they along this maturation process? And the sampling that we're doing in particular is something called single cell RNA sequencing, which is basically looking at the genes that a cell expresses. And that can give us information in terms of what cell type that cell is and what that cell is doing. So whether it is potentially expressing genes that are showing signs of stress or going through development and is at a specific maturation stage. Single cell RNA sequencing is really a window into what a cell type is and how it behaves.
And this question of like what a cell type is, that's like a solved question, right? You know, we know that's that cell type because 20 years ago someone was like, that's that cell type, right? So we just wash our hands of that. We sorted with that problem. Or
yep, that's right.
Yeah. No. Or would you? Or so I mean, okay. The reason I'm asking this because I know you've been thinking about this a lot. But how can you maybe summarize maybe the controversies in this space? Because I think a lot of people would make the assumption that biologists would, you know, have a lot of agreement. Be like, okay, yeah, we agree that this cell type is this cell type for these reasons. But as you say, this new technology, you know, single cell RNA sequencing is really opening up a lot of space for exploration. So yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this area.
Definitely, yeah. Well, I would say the process of understanding the various cells in the body has been a pretty fitful process. And it's been impacted by history. And so over time, cells were described by how they looked, how they behaved, where they were. And that's given us a sort of a mixed bag in terms of understanding what each specific cell is in the body. Now with single cell RNA sequencing, we have the ability to look at what genes each cell in the body is expressing. But that gives us a lot of different information. And it's sort of hard to understand what of that information is relevant and what of that information is potentially noise that is actually clouding the picture in terms of cell type. Previously, as compared to single cell RNA sequencing, people would just look at, you know, the expression of a few genes or the presence of a few proteins and say, okay, if it has proteins A, B, and C or expresses genes A, B, and C, that's a brain cell. And then if it expresses proteins D, F, and G, you know, it's a liver cell. But now we're understanding that the range of different cells available in the body and maybe minute differences between those different cell types are really, really diverse. And it's kind of like the more you zoom in, the more you realize how many differences there possibly are. I'd also say that with the models that we're working with, these sort of stem cell models, they're never going to fully replicate what's found in the body fully. And that adds a wrinkle which can really complicate things, where if I take my stem cells and I grow them into cardiac cells, those cardiac cells that I've grown are a model of a human heart, but they are not a human heart. They may beat and they may express some of the genes found in a human heart, but they don't have the same sort of 3D complexity. They haven't been living in a person's heart for, you know, decades. And because of that, their transcriptomics and the genes that they express are going to be quite different.
And this is where the concept of like cell state comes into it, right?
That's right. And so, actually, yeah, I think so. So
in a way, right? I mean, maybe not in this exact context, but like a cell, you can be like, oh, it's expressing these genes, therefore it's this cell type. Mm-hmm. But if you're taking your cardiomyocytes and putting them in a dish and they're surrounded by 199 other individuals and cells, you know, maybe the that cell type in isn't exactly reflective of the true state that it would be in, right?
Definitely. I mean, I think if you, because we're replicating development in a dish, and because our ability to replicate development in a dish is incomplete and, let's be honest, just a pretty shoddy replication of what's actually found in the body, the cells are not going to reach the same sort of gene expression states that are found in the body. But what we're trying to do is make our models more and more accurate. So that sort of gets back to some of my work in Beth's lab, where we were putting the cells into the mouse brain, where that gives us the ability to recreate that 3D environment. And we would hope that the human cells that are put into that mouse brain are in transcriptomic states, more accurate of what's actually found in the brain.
I have a sort of a controversial thing to raise. I was at a cancer conference a few years ago, and this comment from one of the researchers there has always stuck with me. He's like a big dog cancer researcher, and he was talking about the amount of data produced preclinically on the bench, and this is related to development of targeted therapeutics in cancer. So very different to what you're studying, but he explained how there was little to no, if not a negative correlation between the amount of preclinical data and the complexity of the models that the people were submitting. I think it was a grant system where they were reviewing grants, and to therapeutic output or to translation of that drug. I always just found that so amazing. Like he was sort of raising the argument that we should try to be moving away from bench models and more into patient models earlier, and having the patients involved in the cycles of therapeutic development much more closely. I thought that was a really interesting concept. I wonder, but this also kind of harkens back to you mentioning before about how earlier drug studies were all done using, you know, often isogenic clonal populations of cells, very little heterogeneity, not mimicking the disease biology very closely, therefore, or only mimicking a certain population's heterogeneity, like white people. I just wonder, what are your thoughts about, at least I think he was telling the truth, about how not necessarily adding complexity in the cancer context leads to better therapeutic translation.
I think I agree in some ways. I think that bringing patients into the drug development pipeline more and more is only going to make things faster. I think, of course, that has to be done in a safe way and make sure that when people are actually testing medicines with patients, that's done in an ethical and safe way. I think that in terms of the transcriptomic data question, I sort of disagree. I find that more information gives us the ability to ask more questions. Of course, the nuance there is that it's really hard to understand sometimes what the answer is. And biology very rarely will give you a yes or no answer to a question. And so I think that trying to, or being able to ask, you know, very pointed questions and being able to take a large data set, let's say of 1 million cells, each expressing 10,000 genes, that's a massive amount of data. And you need to come in with a scalpel and be able to say, okay, can I ask a very specific question about a very specific cell type and try and understand how a specific gene is changing? And so I think if we can take this mass, you know, this fire hose of data and approach it with a framework of questioning, then I don't think it's too much of a problem. I do also think in terms of the models and the complexity, it's good. The more we are able to replicate the body, the better our models are, and the better we can predict how the body will respond in certain environments. At the same time, we risk making models overly complex and actually, lose the ability to answer simple questions. So I think there will always be a place for stuff like isogenic cell lines and, simple models of disease. But I think that also a lot of the low-hanging fruit of research has potentially been answered by some of these more simple models. And if we want to actually address some of these, you know, very difficult questions of biology, let's say like how Alzheimer's develops and how we can potentially treat Alzheimer's. People have been working on this for 50 years and there's been almost no progress. We need better and better models of Alzheimer's to understand what's going on in this particular case.
Yeah, it's completely true. Like when there's certain diseases that you literally can't study in a different way, or particularly these rare genetic variations, which you need much larger sample sizes than you're ever going to get from like a disease population. What else are you going to do? I guess the downfall is when people think that the model is going to directly bring you to the cure or to the answer. Where what do they say? Like, no model is correct. Some are useful.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's your favorite book.
Yeah.
This comes from someone who works exclusively with cell lines, and you know, that's an even more basic model. And I think it's, as I say, it's not going to lead to the cure, but it might tell you something fundamental about how cells work or how cancer works, and that's, you know, potentially incredibly important.
I think something I really appreciate about doing a PhD in Australia is I think that there's a very strong translational focus here, and maybe because there's just less research money bouncing around and people have investors or people giving the money want to see more tangible outcomes to their investment. I think that means that there's a drive to answer questions that are relevant to disease, but maybe less of a focus on basic biology, trying to understand how a specific mechanism works, not in any sort of disease context. Yeah, I think to address your point, though, in terms of all models being bad and some are better than others, we need holistic approaches to medicine, and we need the combination of various models to sort of cover up the limitations that each model may have. So how can we layer mouse work with stem cell systems, with, you know, clinical trials, with, you know, biomaterials to try and understand exactly what's going on in the body? Because it is very complicated and difficult to parse out, and how we can, you know, fix those problems that may arise.
So are you still keen on the biotechnology route?
Yeah, I think in terms of my personal career, I think academic research is amazing, and it really gives people the independence to ask questions that they're very interested in. But frankly, also, I find that academic research can be a little bit lonely sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially doing a PhD, you know, you're focused on your specific research project, and you may have supervisors and people collaborating with you, but at the end of the day, it's all your responsibility. And that gives people the opportunity for some very fantastic, personal achievements. But I think I like to work in a team more, and I would want to work collectively with people to solve research problems, where we're much more invested in terms of making sure that everybody is working towards the same goal.
Right. It's really helpful to have a good idea of what it is you don't like and what you do like when you're making that pivot from PhD to the next step. You probably got another, 1.5, 2 years to think more about that. What are some of the skills you've gained so far in your research journey? So the RA journey and now your PhD, that you feel are going to be really beneficial as you do make that leap into a biotech organization?
I've been leading this village work. We've got 5 or 6 people on the team, and I've had to be the project manager, and I'm one of the youngest people on the team. And that's been a fantastic experience in terms of leveraging the different skill sets that we have in the group and making sure that the project stays on track. And I think that it's definitely been a learning process, trying to, you know, understand how can we get all these really complicated pieces to fit together. But it's been so much fun working with this group, trying to take something that's just a concept, so, you know, a 200-person stem cell village, and actually turning that into a tangible research project with actual data. And, you know, that's ranged from, you know, actually acquiring these lines and making sure that they are, you know, as stem cell-like as we expect, all the way through growing these heart models and then trying to understand the functional characteristics of them. So you can look at the beating characteristics using stuff like calcium imaging, You can run something called an MEA, a multi-electrode array. These are all very nitty-gritty tools that give us an understanding of how our heart models are behaving.
Super cool.
Yeah, are there non-technical skills that you think you've developed throughout this PhD or even are there things you didn't expect that you would have to learn during this PhD? Or it's all just running exactly how you planned it.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, every experiment working out fine.
I mean, I think coming in, I was aware of this, but research is always going to give you some high highs and some low lows. And I feel like I've learned how to roll with the punches and understand, you know, one failed experiment is not the death of me, and one great achievement, while I try and celebrate it, is also the opportunity to, you know, think about my next steps and how to move forward from there. So I think, in terms of a personality sort of growth, I think that a PhD is an amazing opportunity to develop resilience.
Because the highs are high and the lows are low.
Yeah, the highs are not that high, but the lows are low. I think also, I try and remind, people complain about doing a PhD all the time, and I try and remind myself often that this is an amazing opportunity that the, you know, UNSW and in some ways the Australian government has chosen me to actually do this research project and is confident enough in my abilities, you know, accurately or maybe in a misguided sense, to actually give me money to do research. And not many people in the wider world are given money to ask questions that they're interested in. So
totally.
Yeah, I am super thankful to be able to work with some researchers that I think are, you know, really bright and can teach me a lot of different stuff technically and also more broadly as a scientist. While there are definitely are difficult days in terms of doing a PhD, like, I'm very lucky to be able to be asking these questions.
Yeah. Well, it's a great place to end it there. And just, yeah, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about your amazing research, and all the best for the next few years.
Yeah. Thanks, dude.
Hope the rest of it goes well. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.